movements by women and how they struggled for equality. At that time, I had very little understanding because in school it was more about getting a flower from a boy, or we would give a card to a teacher acknowledging, you know, and paying respect to her because she's a woman and she teaches and she dedicates her, you know, her time to us. So when I moved from Poland to America, I was very surprised when I discovered how little awareness there was in the States about this powerful day for me. And so what happened was in the late 80s, when I moved, I dedicated myself to making International Women's Day an official day of celebration in the United States. And at that time, I was able to convince at that time Mayor Tom Bradley to proclaim it as an official day of celebration in Los Angeles, and then Governor Pete Wilson, because these were the days. And he did the same for the state of California. I had to do a lot of research and present and share actually with them the history and how it all happened, because the idea for International Women's Day was born at a conference in Copenhagen in 1910. And these were the times when in many countries, women did not even have a right to vote.
On that note, Beata Pozniak, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you for having me.
Call 818-985-5735 and press 2 to become a sustaining member.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Alfredo Rodriguez on Friday, March 22nd at the UCLA Nimoy Theater. Schooled in the classical conservatories of Havana and discovered at the 2006 Montreux Jazz Festival by Quincy Jones, Cuban-born pianist Alfredo Rodriguez's artistry is informed as much by Bach and Stravinsky as his Cuban and jazz roots. More information and tickets at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support KPFK. One of the best ways you can do it is simply by becoming a sustainer, pledging $10 or more each month. In that way, you help to protect this independent radio station. And sign up today.
You can join KPFK's sustainer program by logging on to kpfk.org.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. In his recent article, Uncensored Black History Offers Lessons in Global Struggles for Liberation, Curry Peterson Smith states, quote, "Our time is shaped by Israel's genocidal assault in Gaza, but it is also shaped by the largest mobilization of opposition to U.S. support for Israel in this country's history. And within this wave of protest, we see, among other things, the inescapable connections between Black America and people who are oppressed and marginalized around the world, end quote. He goes on to state, quote, we are at the end of Black History Month, which offers an annual set of conversations about Black history, the unfinished Black freedom struggle, and the ways in which these things have shaped this place and its broader history. While typically official celebrations in February minimize the radical content of Black history and narrow the conversation to within the borders of the United States, an honest look at the full breadth of Black politics over time points to the thought and movements that push against the very foundations of the United States and to a consciousness that extends well beyond its borders, end quote. So with us today to talk about the relationship between the struggle against anti-Black racism in the United States and freedom struggles around the world, including the fight for liberation in Palestine, is our guest, Corey Peterson-Smith, who is the Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at Institute for Policy Studies. He researches U.S. empire, borders, and migration. He is one of the co-authors and organizers of the 2015 Black Solidarity with Palestine Statement, which was signed by over 1,100 Black activists, artists, and scholars. Welcome, Corey Peterson-Smith, to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you so much, Negla. I'm so grateful to be here.
And I'm so grateful for the work you do and the connections that you're making. Very, very important. If we could just jump right in to your recent piece and your work. In the recent article that you came out with, and I encourage all the listeners to go check it out, you state, quote, the time stretching from the early days of the movement for Black lives through now has included a contemporary wave of Black Palestinian solidarity. The year 2014 in particular was seminal, end quote. And I appreciate the fact that you're bringing it to 2014. Can you talk about the ways in which the year 2014 was seminal? Because I think, I don't know that a lot of people remember actually what happened in 2014.
Yeah, I'm so glad to, especially since this is the 10th anniversary, of course, of that year. And this summer, we will have the 10th anniversary of two convergent events, which one of which was the Ferguson Uprising, which happened after police in Ferguson, Missouri killed Mike Brown, an armed teenager. This came after also earlier in the year 2014, the police murder of Eric Garner in Staten Island. And so it was a year really characterized by these high profile incidents of police violence against unarmed Black folks. And the murder of Mike Brown and the uprising that it sparked coincided with the 2014 Israeli bombardment of Gaza. And so during that time, you would turn on the news and see the latest of what happened out of Ferguson that day, you know, in terms of the uprising. And then they would go to what was happening in Gaza that day in terms of the Israeli bombing. And this was a time when Palestinians extended solidarity to the Black freedom struggle. There was not one, but I believe three statements of solidarity from Palestine to the Black uprising in Ferguson. There were messages of solidarity on social media from Palestinians, advice about how to deal with tear gas, which from Palestinians who had dealt with it quite a lot from Israeli forces and to Black folks who were dealing with it in the suburbs of St. Louis. And so that was a moment where the connections were very plain. They're very straightforward. When people did a little digging, the connections were even more evident. People found out that, for example, the St. Louis Police Department trains in Israel. This was the main police department that was responding to the Ferguson uprising. And so the connections abounded. And it was a time when many people interested in the question of Black freedom and Black unfreedom in this country, as well as Palestinian unfreedom in Palestine, saw a convergence in connection between the two.
And, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate in what you're bringing up now and what you bring up in your work and this recent article is this relationship between U.S. policing and Israeli apartheid and violence over time, historically and currently. So one of the things that you talk about in your piece, then bring it, you bring your piece now to 2021, and you say, when in May 2021, Israeli police cracked down on Palestinians in Jerusalem who were worshiping at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, forced Palestinians from their homes in that city and elsewhere, and escorted far-right Israeli marches, people in the U.S. observed with eyes that had been shaped by the Black-led uprisings of the previous year. Can you elaborate on what you were just talking about, on this and the relationship between U.S. policing and Israeli apartheid and violence, both historically and to today?
Sure. And, you know, listeners will know that we are heading into Ramadan now. You know, it's approaching. And I'm sorry to say that the Israeli police forces and armed forces are preparing to do what they prepare to do every single year, which is harass Palestinians going to worship at Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's something that happens every day of the year, but particularly around Ramadan, during that holy month. The Israelis want to show the Palestinians who's in charge. And so that's what happened in May 2021. And that kind of annual just contemptuous Islamophobic kind of violence by the Israeli police, combined with a particularly aggressive effort at that time to forcibly remove Palestinians from neighborhoods in Jerusalem, particularly Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. And so that happened in May 2021. We saw aggressive Israeli police violence in the streets of Jerusalem, which actually ended up ultimately escalating to another round of violence against Palestinians in Gaza as well. But one of the things that made that different was that folks who had experienced the 2020 Black-led uprisings here were watching that and saw it differently. And so, among other things, before I get into the specifics between Israeli police forces and U.S. police forces, it's worth saying that there are similarities in how the Israeli police and U.S. police behave because they have similar projects. You know, the Israeli police, the police within the borders that Israel claims, are policing a population of Palestinians who constitute about 20% of the population. And the police here police lots of people, but particularly Black folks, who constitute 13% of the U.S. population. And historically in this country, we know that the people who run this country have seen the Black population as this kind of problem, you know, that we are this source of what they call crime, that we're this unstable force. And certainly in times like the 2020 uprisings, when many people are raising big questions about the deep histories of this country, it's very inconvenient to have this Black population here, and the police make that clear. And there's a very similar level of vitriol and contempt by the Israeli police, Israeli forces toward Palestinians. So just putting aside what the training looks like, they're going to look similar because they're doing similar things. Now, that said, because they know they're doing similar things, they trade tactics. And it is the case that every major police department in this country and many small police departments train with Israel. And among other things, one of the things we learned in 2020, in the aftermath of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, is that the chokehold that the Minneapolis police used on George Floyd is one that is used by the Israeli police. And so we don't know, you know, of course, they're not public and open with what exactly the agendas of their trainings look like, but we know that they're using some of the very same tactics.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking today about the relationship between the struggle against anti-Black racism in the U.S. and freedom struggles around the world, including the fight for liberation in Palestine, with our guest, Curry Peterson-Smith, who is the Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at Institute for Policy Studies. He researches U.S. empire, borders, and migration, and he's one of the co-authors and organizers of the 2015 Black Solidarity with Palestine Statement, which was signed by over 1,100 Black activists, artists, and scholars. So, Curry, you know, I one of the things I also really appreciate about your work and the recent piece is that, yes, while you're talking about recent history and currently 2014, 2020, 2021, and what we're seeing today, you do a very good job of connecting this to even further back. And one of the things you importantly point out in your piece is that the first time that connections between the struggle against anti-Black racism in the U.S. and freedom struggles around the world, like in Palestine, has actually informed a Black internationalist consciousness here in the United States. Can you talk about how this was the case, for example, with Martin Luther King Jr. and his transnational anti-colonial vision, which honestly is often omitted in mainstream public discourse about King?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really something when we think about the way that Martin Luther King, who in his time was considered quite controversial, and I would encourage listeners, you know, go on YouTube and search for Martin Luther King Meet the Press and see how the mainstream media in Martin Luther King's time treated him. It stands in quite stark contrast to the kind of this canonized figure who has this sort of he's considered this American hero now, but there's this version of King that is taught in schools, that I was taught in school, that really is devoid of his most potent political beliefs in his commentary and his critiques of this country, let alone his really global scope. And so, you know, I do recall, and folks maybe have heard, that King was inspired by Mahatma Gandhi. And the what I grew up learning was that was because of Gandhi's nonviolence. And, you know, certainly that's true, but it was Gandhi was part of an anti-colonial movement in India against British colonialism. That's what King was inspired by. I mean, King really saw himself and many people in the civil rights movement and the Black power struggle of that time saw themselves as part of a global, a transnational anti-colonial struggle. And so Dr. King was present, for example, at the inauguration of Ghana as an independent country in 1957. He was there. He was in the room when Ghana was declared independent. And as we know, the late 50s were a critical time in the civil rights struggle in the American South. And so I think that's so important because the kind of narrative that we get of King and of the civil rights movement is that it was this thing that was sort of localized to the American South in this time. But King had a global scope. The last thing I'll say on that point is, you know, of course, it's important for us to read and know Dr. King's words, and the "I Have a Dream" speech is a phenomenal speech. But I would encourage folks to also check out his other speeches and writings, and particularly "Letter from a Birmingham Jail," published in 1963 when he was arrested for civil disobedience, and he framed the struggle that they were doing in Birmingham in the context of anti-colonialism in the so-called Third World. And he said, the nations of Africa and Asia and Latin America are moving with jet-like propulsion, jet-like speed toward freedom. And we are moving at a horse and buggy pace to be able to sit at a lunch counter. I mean, he was so inspired by the global anti-colonial struggle. And he took that inspiration into his work, what he was doing in the American South.
And Curry, can you maybe reflect a little bit on why you think it is that often what is excluded in that mainstream public discourse about King and even about the struggle against anti-Black racism, that there is this exclusion of yes. talking about the ways in which these struggles and the leaders within it are actually making these connections in terms of transnational anti-colonial movements and struggles.
You know, for the people who run this country, you know, this is the richest and the most powerful country on earth. And that didn't happen by accident. You know, that has come through so many things, but in particular, of course, the foundation for this country's wealth and power really was the dispossession, and I would argue ongoing war against the indigenous peoples of this place that's now called the United States, as well as the enslavement, you know, of Black folks and the use of us to build the economic foundation of this country. And what the U.S. has done all around the world in terms of exploiting resources and using quite a lot of violence to secure those resources and secure a certain world order. Now, the Black struggle here has this role of reminding people what is at the foundation of the United States. And indeed, the conversation in 2020 ushered in finally a more honest conversation about slavery, not just as this thing that happened, you know, a long, long time ago, and that it was relegated to the American South, but this thing that was at the very center of the founding of the U.S. and shaped every aspect of U.S. life here. That kind of like very deep critique, for that to combine with an international outlook, is extremely dangerous, I think, from the perspective of the people who run this country, because they need us to not make those connections. And so I often think about how in 2020, as there were protests all across, uprisings all across this country, there was a point at which the then President Trump wanted to deploy the U.S. Army to repress these protests. And a number of prominent American generals said, no, we don't want to do that. And I think the reason why is not because they were, you know, in solidarity with the movement for Black lives, but because they saw the extent to which the Black struggle once again was shaking this country, and the extent to which it was discrediting the police of this country as policing as rooted in American slavery. And the notion that that same critique could be extended to the military, they didn't want the military to be contaminated with that, because then if you're seeing a force that is repressing people here and whose daily job it is to repress people around the world, that's very dangerous for Americans to make that connection. And so I think that is why so much has been invested into making sure we don't make those connections. And yet again and again and again, the Black struggle tends to put that back on the table.
You know, I think it's one of the great, this type of solidarity, and to your point, always making sure that the Black struggle for liberation is making these connections and really standing in solidarity with liberation struggles around the world, is one of the greatest forms of resistance to the colonial projects of divide and conquer. And yes. I want to talk a little bit more in detail in terms of some of the history about between the struggle against anti-Black racism in the U.S. and, for example, the fight for liberation in Palestine. Can you talk about how other leadership of the Black Power era, such as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, were actually very directly making this connection between the struggle against anti-Black racism in the U.S. and the fight for liberation in Palestine?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this was, I think first I in my own learning and my own kind of journey into knowledge of that era and that kind of solidarity, at first I heard about the Panthers and how the Black Panther Party sent members to Palestine. Huey Newton went to Palestine and went to the refugee camps in Lebanon as well, where Palestinians lived. that the Panthers made connections with the Palestinian Liberation Organization at the Black Panthers Foreign Office in Algeria, for example, and elsewhere. So that was inspiring. But the more I looked, the more I realized that that really just scratches the surface of what was a vast kind of universe of solidarity. And so I'll give a couple more examples, but with the caveat that these are just a few glimpses at what is really a vast history. And so you have the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was the key civil rights organization of its time, you know, which led the sit-ins and so on. And in 1967, this was the year of you know, what some called the 67 War, some called the Six-Day War, but when Israel fought a set of armies from Arab states and ended up seizing a ton of territory that they came to occupy, from Lebanon in the north to Egypt in the south, and including the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. So during that year, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, actually came out in solidarity with Palestine, raised some big questions, interrogated really the U.S. relationship with Israel, and said that the U.S. was on the wrong side of history. So that was one example. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers, whose whole story is this incredible story, and I think a very overlooked one, of the Black Power era. This was a group of revolutionary Black auto workers centered in Detroit, though ended up having folks throughout the country at industrial plants, who really wanted to use their power as Black industrial workers in the key industry of auto to really shake the economy of this country and have a revolution. Amazing story to look into, but one thing that's worth noting, they had this newspaper that came when they took over the student newspaper actually at Wayne State University in Detroit, and they made it into a revolutionary black power newspaper, and they printed articles about Palestine, and in many ways they did this in collaboration and solidarity with the Arab auto workers. Folks will know, if you didn't know already, the large Arab population in Dearborn and elsewhere in Michigan has made itself known by standing up to this genocide that the U.S. is assisting with in Gaza now, just last week in the Michigan primary. And there was great collaboration between Arab auto workers and Black auto workers. And actually, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers was a thorn in the side of the Wayne State University, who was very upset that their newspaper had been taken over by this group of Black radicals. And it was actually when the League of Revolutionary Black Workers published an op-ed on Palestine, that was the basis to go after the League. And so it was a storied kind of solidarity, and one that Black folks paid a price for, but that was really critical part of understanding the Black Power era and that whole era of anti-colonialism.
And, you know, we only have about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to combine my last two questions. I really want to get them both in. Can you talk about how part of the struggle against anti-Black racism in the U.S. was combating COINTELPRO, and how COINTELPRO tactics actually continue to be used today against freedom struggles around the world, like in Palestine, and those advocating for Palestinian human rights here in the United States, and just overall how this history of Black Palestinian solidarity continues to today, and why it's so important to understand this history in relation to today's solidarity in our collective fight for liberation in Palestine and beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, just on the question of COINTELPRO, you know, that's an abbreviation for the counterintelligence program, which was kind of coordinated by the FBI and involved various police forces across this country. And, you know, they targeted various radical organizations and movements in the 60s, but the main target was the Black Power struggle, because in so many ways, it was an engine driving that whole era of radicalism and upheaval, really, for upheaval for good, you know, unsettling an unjust order in this country, and very much in solidarity with the decolonial struggles around the world. And so the COINTELPRO worked to discredit movement forces, worked to divide them, use all kinds of horrific violence, including political assassinations and so on. When we think about discrediting forces fighting for justice, I mean, look at what's happening with Palestine solidarity activists in this country today. I mean, we are witnessing a live streamed genocide, you know, as scholar Noda Erekat says, the world's most documented genocide. And yet we are tarred, we are tagged with the tag of anti-Semite. This is about discrediting a struggle for justice, right? Now, that said, that struggle for justice continues. And I'll just say, in terms of the connections between the Black struggle and the struggle for the Palestinian freedom struggle, what we're in the midst of right now, this wave of protests for Gaza in the United States, this is actually the largest protest wave since 2020, since the Black-led uprisings of 2020. And I don't think that that is coincidental. I actually think that in addition to the decades of work that Palestinians and Palestinian Americans did to bring about consciousness in this country of Palestine and lay the basis for the kind of sympathy we are seeing now, it is also the case that the militant